this nice meeting. I'm learning a lot and look forward to the rest of it. Indeed, I'll try to tell you about algebras of interfaces. So the setup for this talk will be the following. Imagine a two-dimensional plane. So this will be a two-dimensional sheet on which we'll have various interfaces. I'll represent them by oriented lines. So this will be interface 1, interface 2. And my goal will be to ask in various contexts what happens if you try to collide these two interfaces together. So this will be defects, in the sense they're non-dynamical, and they'll be universal, in the sense that Nati explained to us this morning. So my goal will be to ask, what is the product of these interfaces, analogous to operator product expansion? I'll focus on half BPS interfaces. So they'll be half supersymmetric. And for simplicity, again, I'll stick to two-dimensional setting most of the time. But actually, the systems that I'll describe naturally arise in high-dimensional theories, for example, in four-dimensional gauge theory, where you can imagine there is other dimensions of space-time orthogonal to this two-dimensional plane. But since it's easier to draw things on a board and that represents two dimensions, I'll focus just on this two-dimensional slice. But problems that I'll consider arise, for example, when you have surface operator embedded in four-dimensional gauge theory, so then this interfaces or lines will be stuck to the surface operator. Another natural setting which will be relevant to us, and that's where letter Q will appear, is if something else holds this interfaces represented by lines to this two-dimensional plane. And that could be omega background, which rotates to other dimensions of four-dimensional space-time. So if there is a symmetry E1Q representing the omega background, that could be another reason why this line operators I1 and I2 cannot move off the plane. And in either of these cases, or you can consider mixture when you have four-dimensional gauge theory with surface operators and omega background, in either of these or combination of these cases, the algebra that I'm looking for is non-commutative. So for this line defects or line operators, there is also an operation of addition, a commutative operation. I'll ignore it most of my talk and focus almost exclusively on the product. So I'll ask this question, what is the product? And I'll try to give you the answer to this question in three different cases. So in fact, if time permits, I'll give you three different algebras of interfaces. And when I was thinking about giving Blackboard talk, Leonardo warned me that it's very dangerous because especially in 45-minute limit, time may run out. So I'll give you a summary right away. So in case I run out of time. So the first algebra that we'll see arising exactly in this way will be affine Hecke algebra. I'll denote it by H affine. And this is based on fairly dated by now work with Witten, which goes back to 2006. So second type of product or problem that we'll consider will lead us to quantum groups realized as algebras or groups of interfaces. In fact, quantum groups are algebras, or the precise algebra that we'll encounter here is actually a categorification of quantum group. It's called KLR algebra. after Hovhaannov, Lauda, and Rouquier. That's a very interesting algebra, much stronger than quantum group. And surprisingly, it will appear in a very simple, fairly familiar physical setup. So this goes back to 2015 and work with my former student, Sung-Bon Chun, and Daniel Roggenkamp. So this is 2015. And then if I have time, but I actually hope I run out of time, I'll explain why in a second. Third algebra that may arise in this way is second affinization of affine Hecke algebra. This is called double affine Hecke algebra. So this is based on joint work in progress with various people, including Satoshi Nawata, Dupuy, and various others. So this work is not out yet, although Satoshi has been giving talks about this and various other collaborators over the years, in fact, very detailed talks. Preparing for this, I tried to trace where it started, and it started in 2014, so I can tell you when the beginning of this work was, but I don't know where the end is. And if you track imagine that these three applications will be equally spaced, gap here is 9 years, so this means that it should be finished in 2024, which is fantastic because it's exactly 10 years, so there are many coincidences here. And honestly, I think that's actually how long it's going to take for us to finish this, because the story is amazingly delicate. So I'll say a few words about that later. So in each of these three cases, these algebraic structures will be realized by concrete interfaces. So there will be interface, which I'll call T and X. Interface is called T and X, representing line operators whose commutation relations give you affine Hecke algebra. In the context of quantum groups, natural names for these interfaces will be E, F, and K. And in the context of double affine Hecke algebra, you'll have set up very similar to what you have in the affine case in the first example. So in addition to T and X, you'll also add another type of operators that I'll call Y. Morally, this will correspond to just either Wilson or Hooft lines, and this will correspond to both Wilson and Hooft lines if you think about embedding in N equals 4 supernodes. Most of the time, for simplicity, again, I'll limit only to two dimensions. I'll also limit myself to SU2 root systems, because all of these algebraic structures have underlying root systems, and I'll limit myself to just simplest one, simplest non-abelian one. This will be good enough, and if I get to this third point where things get really delicate, what will play a role is a center of this corresponding group in simply connected form. The center is Z2, and classification of line operators and reading between them will become very important in this third application, to which I hope to get. Another remark is that in all of the settings, the corresponding group or algebraic structures will be characterized, as far as the product goes, as multiplication in the fundamental group of the space of parameters. So you can not just think about these algebras in a very dry algebraic way, but also in a geometric way by circling around various loops in the space of parameters. Any questions so far? Feel free to ask at any point. This is Blackboard talk, and I'm not rushing anywhere, especially since I already gave you a summary. Okay. So this will be the three algebraic structures that I'll try to summarize. They share many similarities, and there are certain differences. So each time, hopefully, once we proceed from one to another, we'll learn something new. But in all of these three cases, my main focus will be on what's the product, what's the multiplication when you bring two lines closer together. So my first starting point will be two-dimensional system relevant to the first application, which is perhaps the simpler of all of them, where the two-dimensional theory on this two-dimensional plane, or you can think about it as a world sheet, will be n equals 4 two-dimensional vector multiplet with gauge group U1. So I promised you that I'll talk about SU2 root system, so why am I writing U1? Well, that's because there will be an F equals 2 charged hypers and what the system does for us, it realizes as a linear sigma model, non-linear target, which is hyperkeller quotient. So on a Higgs branch, you'll see two copies of quaternions mod U1. This space is also known as total space of cotangent bundle to CP1 if you turn on the FI term or some deformation parameters. It has lots of complex structures. And the reason it's relevant for SU2, for my original choice of root system, is that it's actually a complex quad joint orbit of SU and F, complexified, namely, in this case, SL2C. Okay. So if I want to ask about interfaces in this kind of sigma model, in this simple theory, which I have BPS, I have to choose a particular subalgebra that I want to preserve, and there are many different choices. So half BPS is equivalent to actually studying topologically twisted theory in some particular choice of either BA model or B model or complex or symplectic structure. So I'm going to focus on B twist. So if you wish, this is just a trick to focus on very specific interfaces and try to remove everything else that you would see in the full superconformal theory where you try to collide these interfaces. Then in the mathematical language, what you're studying is you're studying brains, or more specifically, B brains on X, on this target space. And the relevant question is, what is the space of parameters on which this B model doesn't depend on? So this is moduli space of Keller parameters with respect to this particular choice of B model. And this was studied long ago. It's one complex dimensional. So we have a single U1. It's basically complexified FI parameter, which parameterizes the space. And it's, maybe I shouldn't be ambitious and draw it a little lower. Sorry, what? Yes, I'm in 2D. But many of the systems I'm describing descend from high dimensions. I forcefully try to unify everything in 2D, but some of the structures will naturally lift to 3D. So maybe that's why intentionally I write n equals 4 rather than 4, 4, and so on. Okay, so the moduli space of parameters in this case is what? It looks like a CP1 sphere with three special points. which are traditionally called large volume limit. That's clearly a boundary of the moduli space of Keller structures, where you go to infinity and the size of, say, this CP1, which parameterized by single Keller parameter, becomes very large. There is also a conifold point. And there is orbifold or Gapner point in this moduli space, which is close cousin of the conifold point, except that it has half flux of the B field. And the CP1 is shrunk to zero size. So orbifold or Gapner. So as I said, it's important to think about defects as this sharp but smooth transitions. So again, think about Nati's talk earlier this morning. So if this is my 2D world, this transition may happen over some region in here where I try to change parameters in a continuous but sharp way. And if I'm to interpolate from one theory to the same theory back, I have to make a loop in the space of parameters. I have to come back to myself. So a natural question arises, what is the fundamental group of the space of parameters? Basically, we can go around each of these points or combine this holonomy, so the question about pi 1 becomes very relevant. So the question is, what is the pi 1? Well, this problem was studied in late 90s, and Gemma knows this extremely well since the advent of fractional brains, when people try to look at monodromies of such fundamental group acting on brain charges, for example. Yeah?
Positive or negative with the flop?
Well, in this case, it's n equals 4, so it doesn't. That's usually what we think in n equals 2 case, and this is slightly different. So here, it's the picture is like this with one outer infinity.
So there are no true large volume limits.
No. There is no natural two limits, and that happens when you have rational curve and Calabi-Yau threefold. So then you have a natural flop principle. But that's closely related, and that also has three boundaries with very similar properties. So, that, in fact, there is a close parallel between that system and this one. Any other questions? Okay. So these monodromies were studied earlier, and around large volume limit, monodromy is infinite order, so you generate a Z factor and corresponding monodromy matrix, I'll call it X. If you look at action on D brain charges, you can compute corresponding monodromies in all other regions. For example, you'll find that around conifold point, you also generate you generate Z2, which will be parameterized by monodromy matrix T plus, and at orbifold or Gapner point, you also have Z2 valued monodromy, so it squares to identity with matrix, say, R. So many of them are too long to write, but I'll just write example for T+. In our case, the target space is 4 real dimensional. So if you think about B model, it has holomorphic brains. Namely D0, D2, and D4 brains. There is only one D2 brain because there is only one generator of H2. So if you think how this monodromies act on H even of my target space, then with respect to natural basis of D0, D2, and D4 brains, the matrix of such monodromy around, say, conifold point has the form 1, minus 1, and 1, and zeros everywhere else. And then there are similar matrices that you can produce for all other points. So these are kind of computations which are easy and fun to do, and they were performed from both target space perspective and world sheet perspective in late 90s, early 2000s. So what you find is that your set of lines or monodromies in this system is generated by two guys of order 2, namely r squares to 1, t squares to 1, and their product, of course, x has to be their product because we're on a compact two-sphere, so x is t plus times r. That generates something of infinite order. That's a standard large volume monodromy. So x and let's say t plus generate a group which is semi-direct product of z2 and z generated individually by two of these guys. And this is nothing but a fine, so-called affine Weyl group of the Cartan type that we're studying, namely of SU2. So that's interesting. More interesting question to ask is what happens to the system if I look not at D-brain charges, but at the actual D-brains? And then something interesting happens. Namely, T plus, the matrix that I wrote here, which was action on D-brain charges, does not anymore square to 1. And what we get is T plus square is not equal to 1 when acting on brains in the sigma model. Whereas at orbifold Gapner point, because this is precise, exact CFT, the monodromy is still of order 2. So we still have Z2 here. So what we conclude is that at the level of action on D-brains, the corresponding group is generated by R square, which is squares to 1, and T plus, which no longer squares to 1. And these two generate what's known a fine braid group of type of the same type as U2. This was my simple example, which explicitly can be written as commutator of T with R producing something new. Now that T doesn't square to identity, you can declare that this element is T minus, and as before, R squares to identity. Okay. So this is a simple calculation, in this case of T star of CP1 sigma model, which you can easily generalize and find that, of course, if you work with not just SU2, but more general Cartan types, you produce all these interesting algebraic structures. And
the one you were calling, is it parametrized by T or by something like
Well, I believe it's just T.
Not only, but it's like X verb on T and T, X, R.
No, I'm pretty sure. So details, I mean, we can discuss this later, but I'm pretty sure that this is this has just one large volume limit. And again, it's because the, that's a little different from the flop transition. I think you're thinking about the flop in the context of threefold. But anyway, let's discuss this later. So more generally, if you have more general Cartan types, for example, a fine thinking diagram of either type D or E, your affine braid group is generated by generators T, similar to the ones that I introduced here. T plus was our good old friend, and T minus just appeared. So in general, if you have high rank, you have many more of those T pluses and T minuses, and they satisfy the standard braid relation. So Ti, Tj, Ti, where this indices I and j run over nodes of the affine Dynkin diagram commute to tj, ti, tj, when I and j are connected by edge in this affine Dynkin diagram, and they commute otherwise, ti, tj is tj, ti. Now, if you want to consider a fine while group of same Cartan type, in addition to this, you impose relations that Ti scores to identity. Okay, and what we conclude, or at least what we see in simple examples, is that this guy acts on D-brains in this sigma model. This guy acts on brain charges, or you can say K-theory. But there is also something in the middle when, where, in addition to these braid relations, you impose a relation that Ti doesn't square to 1, but satisfies a relation Ti square is Q minus Q inverse times Ti plus 1. In this case, you get what I call a fine Hecke algebra, and it sits right in between of these guys. And this naturally acts on K-theory, but if you keep track of one additional grading that's present in the problem and that I won't describe in detail. So you have the tower of these three algebraic structures, which act respectively on various either brain charges or brains themselves. And you can indeed realize them as monodromies. In fact, that's what I tried to show you rather quickly in the case of this simplest SU2 case, sigma model, where the affine braid group, for example, comes as fundamental group of maximal torus of your compact group G times its Lie algebra, I'll call it rect T in the tech language. Then you remove from here the locus where something goes bad. These are analogs of 3 points in our Keller moduli space that we talked about before, and divide by the usual while group. So this is precisely the affine braid group. So you might imagine that if you want to pass to my third class of examples right away, without waiting too long, you can just replace this by so-called elliptic braid group, namely take Cartan compact torus, its dual, divide by the while group. So that should be close enough to double affine Hecke algebra, and that's indeed true, but again, realizing that engaged theory is rather delicate, subject to which I may or may not get today. Okay, any questions? So this is one simple example of three closely related algebraic structures. You can generalize it in various directions by putting more elaborate surface operators or lifting it to four-dimensional gauge theory. But the conclusion here is that half BPS line operators in n equals 4 superring mills in the presence perhaps of surface operators form algebras via this OPE type product, which is close cousin of either Hecke algebra or affine Hecke algebra or affine braid group. So my second class of examples will involve something also fairly simple, and I'll start with a two-dimensional system. So in this case, I'll be specific, I'll start with 2D 2,2 minimal model. That's another interesting 2D CFT, probably simplest, superconformal theory. So it has central charge, which is usual 3 minus 6 over n plus 1, where n tells me which minimal model I consider. And it can be realized as Landau-Ginzburg model based on single chiral superfield with a superpotential x to the n plus 1. So, and here and here are obviously the same. In fact, I'll consider interfaces in a slight generalization of this class of theories, namely in 2,2 Kazama-Suzuki models. Set models at level 1, which are realized by SU1 coset over SU n minus k times SUk times U1, where the second parameter k appears, and likewise, they were conjectured to be describable by Landau-Ginzburg models. I'll call this Landau-Ginzburg models LGK. So for me, n is going to be fixed once and for all. So n determines the degree of the polynomials. And k will enter as the number of variables. So the superpotential as a function of what I'll call capital X, chiral multiplets, is basically sum of little x, x1, to the power n plus 1 plus x2 to the power n plus 1, and so on up to x sub k to the power n plus 1. So I'm just adding several copies of these potentials. But I want to rewrite this sum in terms of capital X, which are elementary symmetric functions of little x. So x1, x2, xk. And according to conjecture of Lerche, Waffe, and Werner, this Landau-Ginzburg model that I'll call LGK, labeled by k, should flow to this coset. So again, we'll try to play the same game. We'll ask what are the interfaces in such class of models. So with both n and k, we have quite a bit of freedom. And again, we'll look at two-dimensional system where somewhere here I have interface I. And the simplest type of interface that you can imagine is the one which goes from Landau-Ginzburg model labeled by k to tensor product of two theories, Landau-Ginzburg models labeled by k1 and k2, where morally nothing happens. So I'll explain what this is in a second. So here you choose same model as I put on the board, the superpotential W. Here you write corresponding superpotential in terms of some new fields. I'll call them Y, and I'll tell you how they're related to X's in just a second. And we'll look at the situation where K1 and K2 add up to K. So that I can tell you what nothing happens really means. So the number of fields, the way I chose it, is the same on both left and right. And I want to consider the simplest possible type of interface where we go from x's to y's. So first, if you're trying to describe tensor product of two such theories on the right side, parameterized by fields y, then natural thing to do is to introduce y1 through yk which are analogs of x's. But unlike x's, they'll be not elementary symmetric functions of little x, but rather they're partial symmetrizations. So for example, here I'll say that first few y's from 1 up to k1 will involve only symmetrization of little x's from only 1 up to k1, and so on, ending with sigma k1 of x1 xk1. So this will call variables y with label going from 1 up to k1. Then we can continue and say that we also symmetrize the other guys, xk1 plus 1, xk, and here we'll have k2, xk1 plus 1, xk. So I basically split my set of symmetric functions into partial symmetrizations with respect to the sum where k is split as k1 plus k2. So that's the most natural thing. And here we'll declare that these are fields y with index running from k1 plus 1 up to the whole thing. So in particular, j is 1 through k2. And now the goal is to say, what do I want of this interface? Again, I'll use the same trick. I'll try to treat this half BPS interface in the B-twist of this theory of Kazama-Suzuki model. And in that case, this interfaces can be nicely represented by matrix factorizations. So if I have such interface, which I'll label by k, k1, and k2, it will be a matrix factorization that means a complex of degree 2 with two differentials going between the two pieces, very much like in ADHM quiver, two maps between vector spaces, such that they don't square to 0, but rather square to the difference of the potentials on both sides of Landau-Ginzburg model. So in this case, this should be matrix factorization of W of x minus W of y. And you can write this W of x. There is a very natural and very concrete and specific matrix factorization that I'm going to use that does the following. It basically has two pieces. Second is uniquely determined by the first. And the first piece tells us how xi, capital Xi, is expressed in terms of y's. So matrix factorization will involve two maps. So this is going to be one map. This is going to be the second map. And this functions f basically determine how to reproduce capital X's, which are full symmetrizations of little ones from partial symmetrizations. So this is not too hard to do. For example, in this, in terms of the y's that I introduced, xi's, which are total symmetric combinations, are functions of y, and it's very easy to write what they are. For instance, it starts off as, in our notation, y1 plus y k1 plus 1 when I is equal to 1. This is in degree 1. In degree 2, you have y2 plus y1 times y k1 plus 1 plus y2, sorry, k1 plus 2. That's I equals 2, and so on and so forth. So you can easily generalize what it's supposed to be. So now what this basic interface is doing, effectively it's taking this Landau-Ginzburg model of type K and splitting it off. So think about extra dimension along this interface into two theories which are sitting on top of each other. Tensor product is naturally when you stack theories. So here you'll have Landau-Ginzburg K1. Here you have Landau-Ginzburg K2. And what's happening is that this interface takes this theory and splits it off into two pieces, K1 plus K2, which add up to K. So therefore, in the future, when I write these diagrams, or future is coming right away, I'll basically view this picture from the top. So even though I promise that I'll stick to two dimensions, I'm kind of forced to, or it's better to work with extra dimension when I have this separation of these two pieces, and the picture becomes effectively three-dimensional. So my I interface, this matrix factorization is going to be splitting of these lines labeled by, in this case, K, in this case, K1, and K2. Okay? And now the conclusion that I stated very earlier on is fairly easy to see. It becomes a simple computation. So let me, in terms of these basic interfaces, introduce ENF, which again will be identified with generators of SL2, except that we'll see quantum SL2 appearing in a second. I'll define E to be sequence of these lines, where we start with K1, K2 on both ends. Then we'll have one such interface, I, splitting off 1. And here we'll have, as a result, K1 minus 1. It goes to the second guy. And here it will be, therefore, K2 plus 1. Okay. So similarly, I can introduce interface F, which, again, if picture is read from bottom to top, it will also start with K1, K2, same starting point. So it's a tensor product of two theories. Now I'm viewing this picture from the top, where I have Landau-Ginzburg theory of K1, Landau-Ginzburg theory of K2. I'm omitting LG to simplify the notations. And we'll do transition in the other direction, where one unit of this kind of brain or surface operator, whatever it is, peels off and goes from the right stack to the left stack. And this will be the 4K1 plus 1 and K2 plus 1. Okay. And now you can try to compute what's the product of E and F is. In the theory of matrix factorizations, there is a very precise notion of what it means to consider the fusion of such interfaces. Namely, we can ask what is the product of such interface, the basic one that we call I with itself, as well as this composite guys. And what you find after doing that exercise is that, for example, E star F is basically the same as F star E, except that you have a correction term plus identity interface acting in this space of K1, K2. You can start thinking about these spaces as weight spaces of the corresponding Lie algebra, except that it's now spread out in R charges in a way that if I introduce the corresponding variable Q that keeps track of R charges, I'll find here K2 minus K1 minus Q to the K1 minus K2, Q minus Q inverse. So this looks like quantum dimension. And indeed, this algebra that we found actually is a close cousin, the one I mentioned in the very beginning, of the familiar quantum group, which for SL2 means a commutation relation of ENF is k minus k inverse divided by q minus q inverse. Q is the quantum group parameter. And you have two other key, k times e is q square ek. K times f is q minus 2 f times k. KK inverse is central element, meaning that it's identity. So the inverse is both left and right inverse. So here, if you specialize to value of k, which acts on weight space of dimension k1 minus k2, you get precisely this from this relation. So a technical statement is that this algebra actually categorifies the quantum group, but you can decategorify. And in the past, I always wondered, what is quantum group? Because usually in physics, symmetries, groups are realized as symmetries of something. And quantum group is not really a symmetry that can act on any configuration or anything like that. And also, it's sometimes algebraic structures arise when you collide some brains, and then you see open strings. So a quantum group also doesn't seem to have such interpretation. But now you can say that quantum group is really the algebra of interfaces. Like I said, its proper name should be an algebra. It's algebra interfaces in a very familiar Kazama-Suzuki type model. And I believe I'm out of time, so as promised, I happily skip the third application. Thank you.
Could you explain the physical meaning of Q again?
Yeah, so Q appeared only in the last moment. And what it does, so the way to write this is as follows. So what you get if you compute the product of this matrix factorization, so first of all, it's a little bit of computation. But then what you get is not just sum of some number of terms, including, for example, F and E or identity. So this quantum dimension means that it's taking roughly k1 minus or k2 minus k1 times. But this k1 minus k2 times are spread out in R charge. So the result of this calculation is not that they all sit on the same R charge grading, that they're actually spread out. So you have that many, but in separated. So this notation means that, maybe I should put a bracket over it, but it means this identity is taking n times. But it's like quantum n in the sense that you can keep track of graded pieces in which it sits. You missed something.
We wouldn't expect AOP type structure for besides outside of this topological.
That's a great question, actually. I think we should, and I'm glad to see that there are lots of works aimed at various understanding conformal defects. And in this case, it would be their operator product expansion when they collide in the most naive way. So I think this technology of matrix factorizations can actually help and suggest how to deal with this, at least in such case. Why? Because once you collide these interfaces, you should have asked me, how do you define this star? And obviously, I didn't have time to go through this carefully. But what happens is that you actually get infinitely many degrees of freedom once you squeeze this two defect. So to define the OPE, you have to regularize it, which in this language means factorize some big infinite dimensional piece, which is universal. And I think it's probably, in fact, not probably, I would bet my money or give a case of wine to anybody who does it, because I think it's directly translatable to full physical theory. So we can throw away this crutch.
For local operators, there's a usual picture of the state operator correspondence and, you know, radial quantization, et cetera, where you can really prove the OP and we understand it very clearly. Here, somehow I don't see a similar picture. But.
Yeah, I totally agree. So from CFT point of view, this is nice, and that's where I think there is an opportunity, at least in two-dimensional case. Yeah. I don't know if there are lessons for high dimensions, but probably.